Hey, I'm Steph, and this is Not Today. Hello, and welcome, or welcome back. For those of you who are new here, I'm Steph, and I'm going to be telling you a story of survival. Wherever you're listening, prepare yourself, because this one is a lot. We have a lot to talk about, and it also makes me quite angry. Because although we do have a resolved answer to this crime, the person who was convicted and the survivor don't agree with the outcome. So we're going to be discussing that at length. But before we jump in, I did want to let you guys know there is a bonus episode posted over on Patreon, so if you're interested in getting a bunch of bonus content and voting on stories you want to hear, head over there, because our patrons are the best. But shameless self-plug aside, let's get started with this week's story. Christopher Porco was born on July 9th, 1983, and he grew up in Bethlehem, New York, with his parents, Joan and Peter Porco, and his older brother, Jonathan. The Porcos were described as a classic American family. Peter and Joan were in a loving marriage, and the two of them made good money. Peter worked in the legal field, and Joan worked as a speech pathologist for an elementary school. The family was heavily involved in their church, especially Joan, and they lived in a nice house in a safe neighborhood. The Porcos were also loving parents. They wanted nothing but the best for their children, and both of their sons did well in school. They were academically gifted, and Christopher was also into sports. Christopher was described as very charming. He was friendly and popular and had lots of friends. But according to some family members, Christopher liked to antagonize his brother from an early age. They said he would deliberately wreck Jonathan's things just to be mean, and he didn't really like to see Jonathan succeed. Jonathan also did very well in school, and after high school he became a U.S. Navy officer, so his parents were very proud of him. And it's possible Christopher had a bit of jealousy. But overall, things were good for the Porcos. However, things took a bit of a turn when Christopher left high school and went to college. A darker side of him started to emerge. This side of him must have always been there, but it became pretty apparent around that time, and it's also what we have the most information about because it becomes relevant later. After leaving high school in 2001, Christopher attended University of Rochester in New York. He was an economics major, he was active in ROTC, and the Sigma Pi Epsilon fraternity. And he decided that going to college would give him an opportunity to reinvent himself. And there's nothing wrong with that, but Christopher's reinvention was built on lies. He wanted to impress people, and the best way to impress people in his mind was to make everyone believe that he was filthy rich. It seemed as if he wanted to come off like he was a part of an extremely wealthy family and could do and pay for whatever he wanted. But like I said, Christopher was in a fraternity, and he would shower his frat brothers with gifts. And whenever they had parties, Christopher would fund them. He would buy all the booze and whatever people wanted. He was basically trying to buy his friends. He started telling people he would meet that his family owned huge, lavish mansions all over the world. He would point out random mansions to his friends and claim that was where he lived. And he also told them he had properties in Aruba, a huge luxury lodge in Vermont, and he claimed he owned a mansion in North Carolina. Whenever any of his friends would ask to see these mansions or have him take them there, he would always come up with an excuse as to why they couldn't go, and they started to suspect that the mansion he had pointed out as his childhood home was a random place. They definitely found Chris's stories to be exaggerated and hard to believe, but he always had money on him and was willing to pay. Some people also said he was such a lovely guy that they gave him the benefit of the doubt. And in reality, his family definitely was comfortable. They lived just outside of Albany in a nice house, but they weren't exorbitantly wealthy by any means. And Christopher was spending money like he had it like that. So you might be wondering, where was Christopher getting all this money to fund parties and buy his friends expensive gifts? Because it definitely seemed like he had money. Even if he was lying about the mansions that he grew up in, he always had money on him and was willing to pay. So his friends knew, at the very least, he did have some kind of money. But we'll get into where that came from later. He began telling people that his grandmother was sick and he was set to inherit $2.8 million from her. And he would lie about other things as well. From what it sounded like, Christopher was potentially a compulsive liar, and with so many lies coming out of his mouth, it was hard to keep up with what was actually true. But he kept up these lies for the entire time he was at University of Rochester. And on top of lying, Christopher could also be a bit volatile. He was a heavy drinker and would often skip classes because of his partying habits. And he was allegedly the kind of person who could fly off the handle. He would get into arguments with classmates, which sometimes would be aggressive. And on one occasion, he allegedly threatened to kill one of the girls in his classes. It was reported, which is why we know about it, but I don't have any information on what caused him to say that. There was another occasion when he was in a fight at a party, which wasn't unheard of for him, but this one got intense because Christopher apparently began choking another person and had to be dragged off of him because he wouldn't stop. So that's obviously a lot, and says something about who Christopher was. But let's back up a little. So where did Christopher get all the money he claimed he had and also was using? He stole it from his parents, which is not a very surprising answer. One of the ways he stole from his parents was by staging a break-in and taking their laptops to sell online. It's not just, oh yeah, he went into his mother's purse and took out a 20. It's like he staged a break-in and sold technology online. That's not a small thing to do. That's pretty major in my book. He was home for Thanksgiving break, and before going back to school after the holiday, Christopher did exactly that. He stole their laptops and sold them on eBay. His parents did report the break-in to police because they believed someone had broken into their house, but nothing was ever done because the police couldn't figure out who had done it. So Joan and Peter had to replace both of their computers out of their pocket. And after they did that, Christopher staged another break-in and took the new laptops. Once again, his parents reported it because they didn't suspect their son, and again, nothing was done. And although that was the first break-in Christopher staged, it wouldn't be his last. He also staged a break-in at a vet clinic that he worked at. He stole laptops, cell phones, cameras, and once again, he got away with it and sold all of it on eBay. And on top of that, he started scamming people on eBay. He would list items multiple times and scam people out of their money and never send what he listed. When people would get angry and report him, Christopher would reply back to them pretending he was his brother, and he would tell them that Christopher had died, so there wasn't anything for him to send. Nothing like faking your own death to scam people out of money. Also, I just want to point out that he was like 20 years old at this time. Could have even been in his teenage years. Maybe 19, 20. That just feels relevant to me because these are such extreme things to be doing at such a young age. And his parents didn't know about any of it yet. In 2003, Christopher had been at University of Rochester for about 2 years, and although he was a smart guy, he never wanted to do any of the schoolwork or go to class, so he failed out of school. And when his parents found out, they were pissed. With good reason. And it wasn't because he wasn't good at school or couldn't handle it. They were mad at him because they felt Christopher was just throwing his life away. He wasn't applying himself, and that is incredibly frustrating. But despite that, they were still very supportive of their son. They genuinely wanted the best for him. Christopher claimed his expulsion was because of a particular professor, and it wasn't his fault. And I don't know how much his parents believed that, but they came up with a plan for Christopher to attend Hudson Valley Community College, get his grades up, and then get back into Rochester. But Christopher didn't care. Immediately, he started skipping classes and missing assignments, and his grades tanked once again. In spring of 2004, Christopher decided he deserved a little bit of fun for his spring break. So he told his parents that his grades were great, which is why he deserved to go to London for spring break. And that's what he did. But while he was over in London enjoying himself, his parents got a letter from his school with his grades. And, as we know, they were terrible. And his parents were so mad once again, but mostly because Christopher had lied to them. So they sent Christopher an email while he was on spring break, and the subject line of that email was, "Failing grades, you did it again." It said, "You just left, and I can't believe my eyes as I look at your interim grade report. You know what they say, 3 strikes and you're out. Explain yourself." They gave him the old 3 strikes and you're out. They were mad, and rightfully so. Christopher had been lying to them up and down, and they didn't even know the extent of it yet. When Christopher got this email, he initially ignored it, but he knew he had to come up with something quick because they had a letter from his school telling them exactly what his grades were. So it's kind of hard to deny that one, but he's gonna try. So he told his parents they sent them the wrong grades, and there must have been a misunderstanding because he could prove it to them when he got home. His parents were skeptical, but still they wanted to believe their son. So when he got home, he forged a report card and showed his parents that one, and they believed him. But Christopher didn't stop there because he thought he did a pretty good job with that forged report card, and he decided to use that to reapply to the University of Rochester. He forged multiple documents and records that said he had gotten amazing grades during his time at the community college, and he sent that in. And here's the gag of it all. He got in. The school didn't check any of the forged documents, and he got back into University of Rochester, which of course only further validated his lies to his parents that he had been getting good grades, because when does that happen? He couldn't possibly be lying because they let him back in. But, of course, in true Christopher fashion, he didn't stop there. He told his parents that the university had actually reached out to him and said the whole thing was a misunderstanding, and to make up for the trouble they put him through, they would be covering the cost of that year's tuition. These are incredibly bold claims he's making. And in the fall semester of 2004, Christopher was back at University of Rochester once again. And now that he was back in classes, he told his parents he needed money for textbooks. And according to him, his books were very expensive, so he told them that he would need $2,000. That was a lot of money, but in his defense, books can be quite expensive. So his parents, who only wanted the best for him, without even thinking twice about it, agreed to loan Christopher the money. His father told him they would go to the bank, and he would co-sign a loan for him. And after his father co-signed a loan with him for $2,000, Christopher took his information and then forged his father's signature to apply for a $31,000 loan. Without his knowledge, of course. He used that $31,000 to pay off his tuition fees, which he said were being covered by the university, which obviously was not true. But that wasn't it. He took out another loan for $16,000 and bought himself a brand new yellow Jeep Wrangler. So in one fell swoop, he put his father $47,000 in debt, and he didn't even know it. Christopher reportedly also had debt of his own, because he apparently had a bit of a gambling addiction, and he had racked up $40,000 of debt himself, and at some point it was believed that he stole more money from his parents to pay off part of that debt. It's really so interesting to sit here and try to think about what could have been going through Christopher's mind at that point, because it must have been not much. Because logically speaking, at some point, he knew his parents would find out about both of those loans, so he was just fully prepared to burn the bridge between him and his parents, like, in a big way. He took out almost $50,000 in loans without his parents' knowledge. Did he think he was just going to get away with that? Or did he just not give two shits? I don't think he cared at all. I think he just hoped it would take them a while before they realized. But unluckily for him, it didn't take very long for his father to figure out what Christopher had done, because the bank called Peter about the repayment of the loans. And he nearly lost his mind when he saw that he had a loan for $31,000 and $16,000. He was only expecting to see that $2,000 loan that he co-signed. But instead, he got slapped with $50,000. He saw that the $31,000 loan had been paid directly to University of Rochester, and he saw that the $16,000 loan was for a brand new car, the yellow Jeep Wrangler that his son had been driving around in. So obviously, he knew exactly what had happened. And he was, of course, furious when he put everything together, because who in their right mind would do something like that? I'm angry for him. And that was when he sent Christopher a few emails. But when his son didn't respond to any of the emails or answer any of his calls, he sent another furious email to Christopher saying that he would have to repay all of the money, and if he didn't, he would have to take legal action against him. The final email said, quote, I want you to know that if you abuse my credit again, I will be forced to file forgery affidavits in order to disclaim liability, and that applies to the Citibank college loan. If you attempt to reactivate it or use my credit to obtain any other loans, I have to take legal action against you. But even though his father was threatening legal action against him, at the end of the email, he said something along the lines of, even though we're disappointed and frustrated, we still love you. Which says a lot about who these people are. I know that a parent's love goes very far for their child, but for him to say that at the end of that email specifically clearly shows that he cared deeply about his son, even in this time where he should have been unbelievably angry, and he was. He still made an effort to be like, by the way, love you, and it'll be okay. And unsurprisingly, Christopher ignored that email as well. He continued to ignore any calls or emails from his parents, so Joan emailed Christopher expressing her genuine concern for his mental state. She urged him to contact them and told him that she loved him and only wanted the best for him. And that was only a few days before the attack. On November 15, 2004, Peter Porco hadn't shown up for work that morning. Peter's coworker, Michael Hart, decided he should go and check up on his friend since it wasn't like him to not show up for work. So he headed to the Porco home. The Porcos lived in a house on Broccoli Drive in Delmar, just outside of Albany. When he pulled up in front of their two-story house, everything appeared to be normal. He pulled out his cell phone and dialed their home number twice, but nobody answered and there was no movement inside the house. Michael called his boss, who encouraged him to go up and knock on the door, so Michael kept his boss on the line as he walked up to their house. But as he got closer, Michael realized something was terribly wrong. The front door was slightly open and there was a key that had been left in the front lock. Even more alarming was there were smears of blood on the door handle, and several droplets were splattered around the porch. Michael also heard the faint sounds of the Porco's golden retriever barking from inside the house. He asked his boss if he should go in, and he told him to enter with caution. So Michael peered inside before he quickly told his boss that this was a crime scene, and he called 911. When police arrived at the scene, they found Peter lying motionless at the base of the front stairs in a pool of blood. It was clear he had severe head injuries, and he was declared deceased. When first responders arrived at the scene, they were shocked at how much blood was everywhere. When they made it upstairs, they found Joan lying horizontally on their bed. The walls above her were splattered in blood, as were the bedside tables, and based off of the lacerations on her upper arms and hands, it was clear that she had been trying to defend herself. But the main damage was to Joan's head. One of her eyes was split in half, and the side of her jaw was hanging from her face. Joan had been struck 3 times to her face and head, but somehow, to the surprise of everyone in that room, she was still clinging on to life. It was clear from the blood spatter on the walls that only one assailant had carried out this attack, and lying at the foot of the bed was a single axe covered in blood. Peter had suffered 16 blows to the head, and since he had received 13 more blows than his wife, it was detectives' belief that he may have been the intended victim. A medical examiner was able to shed light on this bizarre and horrifying scenario. Based on the blood spatter analysis and the nature of Peter's wounds, they were able to piece together what happened. The morning after the attack, Peter's alarm went off, as normal, and after being struck 16 times in the head, Peter was still alive and conscious, and he got up for work. He climbed out of bed and went about his normal morning routine. When I heard this, I was absolutely floored. I had never heard of someone being struck in the head 16 times with an axe, and they're not only still alive, but able to walk around and carry out their morning routine. An autopsy showed that Peter had received severe damage to the part of his brain used for higher order functions such as perception, decision making, and language. However, the part of his brain that controlled primal instincts as well as formed habits was undamaged, making it possible for him to go about his morning routine as normal. It was unbelievably sad. Peter was almost in a zombie-like state. He didn't really know anything that was going on. He was moving purely on instinct. After getting himself up from bed, he walked from the bedroom to the bathroom and stood over the sink, looking at himself in the mirror and seeing that he was covered in blood, but his brain couldn't process what he was seeing. He saw that there was blood in the sink, and he started cleaning it up with tissues. He couldn't recognize that it was his blood. It seemed as if no part of him even recognized that he was the one in trouble. All he knew was that there was blood in the sink and it needed to be wiped up. Next, he started making his way downstairs and walked into the kitchen. There was even evidence that he tried to unload the dishwasher and he started making himself lunch. He even stepped outside the front door to get the newspaper, but when he went outside, the door shut behind him and he accidentally locked himself out of the house. But he remembered they had a hidden key under a flower pot, so he got the spare and let himself back into the house and left the key in the door. He then started to head back to the kitchen, but at that point, he had lost far too much blood and he collapsed on the stairs where he sadly passed away. That is one of the most unbelievable things I've ever heard, and according to the people on the scene, it was one of the bloodiest crime scenes they had ever seen. But it wasn't because an attack had been taking place throughout the entire house. The attack only happened in the bedroom. But then Peter got up and continued to bleed everywhere in the house. It's incredibly tragic. The only possible sliver of a silver lining in this scenario is that he wasn't aware of what was going on as he passed away. So hopefully there wasn't any kind of fear. It's just incredibly messed up, and not to mention, the way they were attacked was incredibly personal. Typically, when a person is attacked in the face with an object like an axe, it isn't a random act. It's usually someone who knows the person, and it's a very personal thing. So that in itself was telling. But Joan, after the attack, remained in bed where she was clinging to life. Paramedics said she was lying on her back, her left eye was missing, her jaw was crushed, she had teeth missing, and her skull was fractured in several places. She was in terrible shape. The fact that she was even still alive at that point was a miracle, but now they had to make sure they could get her to the hospital to save her life. While she was being stabilized, Detective Christopher Bowdish took the opportunity to ask her a few questions. He didn't necessarily believe she would survive those kind of injuries, and while he had her there, and she was responsive, he figured it's the best time to get any kind of information out of her because it could be the difference between finding her killer and not. So like I said, Joan was responsive, and he asked Joan if she could hear him, and she nodded yes. He asked her if a family member had done this to her, and she nodded yes. He asked if her older son, Jonathan, had done it, and she shook her head no. When he asked if Christopher had done this, she nodded her head yes once again. And to this detective, that was the answer. Christopher had done it. He said that to him, it seemed as if she could absolutely hear him and understand him. She was responding very clearly to his questions. But at the same time, she had been through an immense amount of trauma. And later on, people would say that what she had said in that state shouldn't be considered fact. And while I can understand that there is a very good chance that she didn't know what she was saying, at the same time, the person who was in the room with her and asking her these questions seems to believe that she was absolutely responsive and knew what he was asking her. But we won't truly know if that's the case or not, ever. So, who's to say? 23-year-old Jonathan was an officer in the U.S. Navy and was stationed in South Carolina. 21-year-old Christopher, as we know, was a student at University of Rochester. But before officers could get a chance to contact Christopher themselves, the Times Union newspaper had called Christopher to interview him about his parents' death. And that was supposedly the first time he had heard about it. Christopher called the police that were local to his parents and asked about it. And in the phone call, he sounds completely unaffected, and I know we can say that trauma affects people in different ways, and we shouldn't measure whether or not a person is guilty or not by the way they sound on a phone call after getting traumatic news, blah, blah, blah. You know, it doesn't necessarily prove he's guilty, but it doesn't make him sound innocent, I will say that. So I'm going to play a small snippet of this phone call so you can hear what he sounds like, and I'll let you decide.
Police dispatcher saying Yes.
Hi, my name is Keith Corco. I was just called by the Times Union saying that my parents were found dead this afternoon. I was wondering if you had any information on me.
Hey, Chris, where are you?
I'm at school in Rochester, New York.
Okay, are you in a dorm there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Do you have a dorm name, or...?
It's called Monroe.
Okay. You're hearing from the Times Union?
Yeah, they called me and said my parents were found, I guess, dead. I don't know. They didn't say how or anything.
Let me try and find you somebody who may have some more information for you.
So, the sound quality isn't the best, but you can basically hear Christopher say, I heard that my parents were found dead this afternoon. Like, you know, not exactly those words, but pretty much sounding exactly like that. Which doesn't sound like someone who just found out that their parents were killed, in my opinion. Because although that is very shocking news, I would be distraught and not just very matter-of-factly saying, oh yeah, my parents were found dead. So anyway, doesn't prove any guilt. But it's weird, at the very least. I think we can all agree on that. And at around 3 p.m. on November 15th, 2004, Chris's girlfriend checked her messages and saw that she had a text from him that simply said, "My parents are dead." She had been texting Chris all day, and earlier that morning, she said she was aware that something had been going on. He had texted her that he wasn't feeling well, and he had tried to get into contact with his parents, but they hadn't answered him all morning, which made him nervous. And after telling her, "My parents are dead," he didn't message her again. After that, Christopher was finally contacted by Detective Bowdish, but he was having reception issues on his cell phone, so they had Chris call them back. He told the detective his uncle would be bringing him to Del Mar, but the last time he had seen his parents was 3 weeks prior. He told detectives he had emailed his father that afternoon about college loans, but he hadn't gotten a response. And that's when he learned that his mother was still alive. He asked what his mother's condition was, but they didn't have any answers for him. Christopher drove the 3 hours with his uncle to the hospital his mother had been treated in, and while he was in the waiting room, Christopher was greeted with hugs from friends and relatives who had gathered there as well. But it was around that same time that a family friend informed Christopher that he was a suspect in his father's murder and his mother's attack. Christopher couldn't believe that anyone would think he could attack his own parents. But that was when he was approached by Detective Bowdish, who wanted to talk with him, which was when Christopher went with them to the police station for questioning. He told police he had been periodically visiting his parents, but he hadn't stayed with them for 3 weeks, like I said, and he strongly denied any involvement in the attack. When they asked if he had committed the attack, Chris said, "You know, I can't say enough, absolutely no. I would never do that to anyone, let alone my parents, who I love dearly." When Detective Bowdish told Christopher that his mother had been communicating with them and said that he was at the house that night, Christopher responded with, "I don't know why she would say that." He gave investigators an alibi, saying that he went to dinner with a friend in Rochester at 9:30 p.m. and returned to his dorm afterward. He spent the evening messaging his girlfriend, Sarah Fisher, and then fell asleep on the couch in his dorm common room at around 11:30. He then woke up at 8 a.m. and went on a run. He said he only went back to his room to grab a pair of shoes and then went on a mile and a half run, which was only about 20 minutes long. And after hanging out with a few different people that morning, he headed back to his dorm, which was when he was contacted by the Times Union. So obviously police had to check up on that. But other than that, he cooperated with investigators, telling them he wanted to be as helpful as possible so they could find the killer as quickly as possible. So he let them take his fingerprints and blood for testing. He even let them examine his body for any superficial injuries that might indicate his involvement. He also gave them his clothes for examination, but nothing came from any of that. He didn't have any injuries, and only Peter and Joan's blood and fingerprints were found at the crime scene. And even if they did find Christopher's prints in the home, it wouldn't have carried much weight because it was his childhood home. They would have had to have found his fingerprints on the murder weapon itself for it to mean anything, and they didn't. And the axe didn't have any fingerprints on it, so they wouldn't get anything from that. After being questioned for 6 hours, Christopher was allowed to leave the police station and went back to the hospital. During their investigation, police found no signs of forced entry. A key had been found in the door, and the door was open, but as we know, Peter was the one who put the key in the door and opened it. Joan's wallet had been out on the counter and was still there, and Peter's wallet hadn't been taken either, so there wasn't any sign of robbery. Although whoever had attacked the Porcos tried to make it look that way. Drawers had been pulled out, but none of the contents had been spilled, which was a pretty common sign of someone trying to stage a robbery. They also found the family dog had been locked in the basement. Detectives found that the phone lines had been cut and the alarm system had been smashed, but upon further investigation, they learned that the alarm had actually been disabled using the code, which was something only 6 people knew. Detectives also found a window in the garage that had been slightly open and the screen was cut, which initially they thought was the point of entry for whoever had done this. But when they tried to open the window further, it wouldn't budge. Peter had drilled bolts into the window to keep it from opening more than 4 inches, and no person could have fit through that. And later on, a representative from the alarm company said that the alarm disconnected from the phone line at 4:59 a.m., more than 2 hours after the alarm had been deactivated with the family code. It was pretty compelling stuff, because whoever had done this, I'm sure, didn't realize that typing in the code to the family alarm system would have been recorded and could be tracked later. Because clearly they smashed the alarm, thinking it would look like a robbery, but they had the code and cut the phone lines, which happened at 4:59 a.m. Again, I'm sure they didn't realize that cutting the phone lines would have a timestamp attached to it, but it did. So it gave the police a pretty decent time frame as to when this could have happened, because the initial code was punched into the alarm system at, I believe, around 2:15 a.m., and then the phone lines were cut at 4:59 a.m. So that's somewhere around 2.5 hours that the person who did this was in the house, which is a very long time for an attack like this, especially since nothing was taken. So it was all very strange. But also, the police are just kind of putting the puzzle pieces together based off of what Joan had already told them. After Joan's surgery, Christopher stood vigil by her side as she was in a medically induced coma. A youth minister comforted Chris, but apparently said his behavior was quite odd. According to him, he didn't sense any grief from Christopher, which, again, was very strange. And just over 200 miles away, investigators were checking up on Christopher's alibi at his dorm room in Rochester. He maintained that he had been asleep on the common room couch on the night of the attack. While students did say they saw him on the couch at 10 a.m. that morning after the attack, no one could say that he was on the couch for the rest of the night. In fact, several students claimed they had been having a movie night, watching Shrek 2, in the common room, and they were there until 3:30 a.m., and Chris definitely wasn't there at that time. It was only a small square room with some couches and a television, so if he had been there, they definitely would have seen him. 3 weeks after the attack, Joan Porco woke up from her coma, which was incredible. She had suffered severe injuries in the attack, including the loss of her left eye, a portion of her skull had to be removed, she had permanent scarring on her face, and her voice was affected, allowing her only to speak in a quiet whisper. But against all odds, Joan survived. When she woke up, she had no memory of the attack. She could recall her activities that day leading up to it, like working in the yard and going to church, but she had no memory of that night, and she swore up and down that Christopher had nothing to do with it. She also said she couldn't remember identifying Christopher as her attacker and denied ever doing so. Now, this was very shocking to the police, of course, but it does make sense. She sustained an immense amount of trauma. Absolutely unbelievable injuries. So the idea that she could have forgotten what happened to her, just based on her trauma alone, is plausible. Also, it's possible that there is some level of denial mixed into this. The brain is a very strong thing, and if you don't want to remember something, you won't, in certain scenarios. But personally, I believe that she has absolutely no memory, and the idea of her son being behind the murder of her husband and the brutal attack of her is far too much for her to grasp and also would be unbelievable. Clearly, she had a lot of love for her son and, like I've said a few times at this point, wanted nothing but the best for him. So I'm sure, as a mother, you could not really believe that your son would be capable of something like this. And also, if she was actually conscious enough to understand what the police had been asking her when they found her at the crime scene, and Christopher had done it, she was willing to say that it was him, even if that broke her heart. But at this point, she's taking that statement back, so I believe that she has no memory of the situation. Anyway, point being, she took her statement back, and that did affect things. Once Jones stated Christopher had no involvement, she pleaded with the district attorney's office to stop looking into Christopher and start looking for Peter's quote-unquote real killer. She even gave a videotaped deposition for police claiming her son was innocent. So that led police to look into other possible suspects. Even though they still felt like it was Christopher, they had to consider other possibilities. They discovered Peter had a recent threat from a man named Patrick DeLucia, I believe is how you say it, who had lost custody of his kids before the New York State Supreme Court, where Peter had worked. He took the threat seriously and decided to protect himself by keeping a handgun next to his bed, but as time passed with no incident, Peter felt safe enough to store the gun away in the closet. Police still believed it could have been a possibility that Patrick was waiting for the perfect moment to strike, so they found him and they took him in for questioning, but he had a solid alibi that proved he was not involved, so he was ruled out as a suspect. Not long after that, the police caught wind of a suspicious letter that was delivered to the Times Union newspaper headquarters in Albany, which was just north of Delmar, where they lived. They had received an envelope, and when they opened it, a white powder fell out of it, so they immediately contacted police. Inside was a note that confessed to the murder of Peter Porco. It said, quote, "Peter Porco was not even a challenge. Once I got inside, I repeatedly hit him in the head and neck with a small axe I brought with me. I ignored all of his pleading screams. I also beat Joan Porco, but unfortunately she survived. If you ever want to find me, you might want to stop going after easy suspects. Show me some respect I deserve. Catch me if you can." It's a bit over the top for my taste. And in theory, this could have been a very significant lead, but the police had doubts of its authenticity. They questioned why a killer would willingly come forward and tell police not to focus on easy suspects. It seemed like someone wanted to divert the attention of the investigation towards some random serial killer. They were like, yeah, okay, this is pretty fake sounding. And when I initially heard the letter, I was like, really? You're gonna say, stop looking into the easy suspects? That's like pretty much drawing a circle around yourself and being like, don't look at me. The police couldn't find where the letter had come from and also determined that the white powder was harmless. A police lieutenant who was questioned about the case said he didn't consider the letter to be a break in the case. It was just an intriguing path they were exploring. Very interview appropriate answer. But what he didn't share was that the police had already determined the letter was a hoax. But at the same time, they still had to look into who could have wanted Peter dead. And surprisingly, he did kind of have a connection to criminal activity. Not directly, but his uncle Frank Porco was a known mobster in New York. 30 years before the attack, Peter's uncle Frank had attended his and Joan's wedding wearing expensive jewelry and carrying a gun, like a true mobster. And there had been rumors that Frank had betrayed someone he was working with and they could have wanted revenge on him, which could have been motive for Peter's murder. For a bit, this theory gained traction because the attacker had used an axe, and Peter's uncle Frank was known as Frankie the Fireman because he killed 2 people with an axe in the past. So they thought maybe it could have been Frankie because Peter was going after him for some legal purposes, or he could have been. Or it could have been someone trying to take revenge on Frankie by killing his family. But further investigation revealed that the axe used was not a fireman's axe, but just a regular one. And not only that, but it was from Peter's garage. And he had purchased it from a local hardware store. And Frankie was in prison at the time of the murder, so it definitely wasn't him. And also, if someone wanted to take revenge on him by killing his family, they most likely wouldn't have killed his distant nephew. They would have killed someone closer to him, like his kids, which I believe lived in, like, New York City where he lived, and would have made a lot more sense if it was a revenge thing, but it clearly wasn't. So, ruling that out, they looked into the history of the Porco family because they wanted to uncover everything, which was when they discovered that Peter had reported a burglary 2 years prior on November 28th, 2002, while Christopher was home for Thanksgiving. And we did talk about this earlier. Christopher staged burglaries and stole laptops and sold them on eBay. So now police are discovering this, and they found that the person who had done this had broken a window and cut the screen to steal these laptops. And on July 21st, 2003, was another time that Christopher was staying in the house, and there was another burglary. Joan's laptop was stolen, along with some other electronics. And in June of 2003, the vet clinic Christopher worked at had a burglary where the window was smashed, and the alarm had been turned off, and a number of electronics was stolen. And then the alarm was reactivated, clearly indicating that it was an inside job. And after finding all of that, police discovered that Christopher had an eBay account and all of the stolen items had been sold through this account. And to confirm their suspicions, they traveled to San Diego and recovered Joan's stolen laptop from the person who had purchased it. They also found John Kearney, the owner of the veterinary hospital's stolen cell phone, in a safe in Christopher's bedroom at the Porco home. I mean, come on. There is so many things that he has done that is simply lazy and stupid, but, you know, hey, it's not like that uncharacteristic for him, so I guess there is that. They also found out about his scams through eBay, and this information became crucial because it became clear that Christopher wasn't as innocent as he was claiming to be. So everything was starting to fit together. And Detective Bowdish recalled at the time of the stolen laptops that he felt like the crime scene had been staged, but he couldn't prove it. And of course, his suspicions only increased after the axe attack, because similar to the laptop robbery, a mesh window screen in the garage had been slashed, indicating the intruder's point of entry. But since the first robberies, the garage window had been bolted shut and was covered in cobwebs, so it was very clear that no one had come through there, and whoever had done it had cut the screen after already being inside. And through their investigation, detectives also learned that Peter and Joan Porco had taken out a life insurance policy worth $1.1 million, and after their death, all of that money from the policy would go directly to their sons. However, what raised suspicion even more was that Christopher had gone to a financial advisor just a month before the attack in October. Detectives also questioned Christopher about why he was telling friends he was about to get $2 million from his grandmother's death, and he said it was just to make himself look cool. They also discovered he and his girlfriend had been in Albany the previous Friday discussing buying real estate, and once again he told them it was just to make himself look good. So all of that evidence is pretty compelling stuff, but it got even worse for Christopher because he had chosen to buy a bright yellow Jeep, which tends to stand out. Police found a lot of evidence of Christopher's Jeep driving from his dorm almost all the way to his parents' house on the night of the murder. 4 security cameras on Rochester's campus caught a yellow Jeep Wrangler leaving the campus at 10:36 on the 14th. Approaching 11 o'clock on the night of November 14th, a bright yellow Jeep Wrangler caught the attention of John, who was a toll booth attendant. He had been on the lookout for a new car for his son, and he had always loved Jeeps. So when he saw the bright yellow Jeep, he took note of it. It was a particularly nice model and had wide tires and black canvas top, which he liked. When it pulled up to his booth, he recalled the driver was a white man in his 20s wearing a baseball hat and was traveling alone. The man paid the toll in cash and then went on his way down the highway. Just over 3 hours later, Karen Russell, who also worked at the toll booths, spotted the same yellow Jeep Wrangler. Her toll was located 230 miles west of the first one on Highway 87, which was on the way from Rochester's campus to Christopher's parents' house. At 1:51 a.m., she noticed the Jeep speeding down her lane before coming to an abrupt stop in front of her booth. Again, the driver was described as a young man with brown hair. She collected the toll, and then he hit the gas and sped off into the night. The car stuck out to Karen that night because he was driving so fast and recklessly, so she remembered the car vividly. And the alarm at the Porco residence was disarmed, like I said, at 2:15 a.m., which would have been the exact right time for Christopher to have been at that toll booth and then get to his parents' house. It would have taken that exact amount of time for him to pull into the driveway and disarm the alarm. And at 4 a.m., the Porco's neighbor, Marshall, got into his car to head off to work that morning, but as he turned out of his driveway, his headlights lit up the Porco's home, and he caught a glimpse of a yellow Jeep Wrangler in their driveway. This wasn't the first time Marshall had seen this yellow Jeep, so he knew exactly who it belonged to, and seeing it there wasn't odd at all. He thought nothing of it, and continued on his way to work after spotting it. But the timing of that yellow Jeep being spotted that night were extremely telling for detectives. Not only had there been witnesses along the tolls, but the car had also been caught on CCTV footage. It was unfortunately too blurry to make out a plate number, but thankfully for them, it was a pretty distinct car. And a video analyst was able to enhance the video enough to see that there was a torn barcode sticker on the passenger door and an oval sticker on the spare tire cover. And that was exactly what Christopher had on his bright yellow Jeep Wrangler. So there was very little doubt as to who the car belonged to at that point, but those small details definitely sealed the deal. The day after Christopher's parents were attacked, his Jeep Wrangler was seized for forensic examination because Christopher was being very cooperative at the time. Images of his car were compared to the CCTV footage, and they were a match. And Marshall, the neighbor, had confirmed that it was Christopher's Jeep in the driveway at 4 a.m. Even more than that, police found out that security cameras had been installed around the exterior of Christopher's campus in the parking lots. So they examined 880 hours of footage in which Christopher's Jeep was seen leaving the campus at 10:30 p.m. and then pulling back in at 8:30 a.m. The timing lined up exactly with the amount of time it would have taken him to drive through each of the tolls and then to his parents' house, commit the murder, be there for like 2 hours, and then drive back to get back at 8:30 a.m. It was perfect. And shortly after 8:30 a.m., Chris was spotted wearing a baseball hat and jogging toward his dorm. And at 10 a.m., he was seen sleeping on the common room couch, where he said he had been all night. So, it's appearing like he was just trying to be seen as he was going on his morning jog, and then he fell asleep, quote-unquote, on the couch, which is where he said he was all night, which was his alibi, hoping that someone would have seen him on the couch and would be able to say, yeah, he was on the couch. Not quite, Chris. As police searched Christopher's car, they found an electronic Easy Pass on the floor of his Jeep. And for those of you who don't know what an Easy Pass is, it's usually put on the dashboard or inner windshield of a car, and it electronically pays for tolls at toll booths, so you don't have to wait in line and manually pay cash. Very convenient stuff. But detectives suspected that Chris had removed his Easy Pass from its usual spot and opted to pay cash. That way he didn't leave a digital footprint as he went through the tolls. Too bad for him, his car is too noticeable. Even luckier for the police, the toll tickets collected on the night of the attack hadn't been destroyed, and both of them contained mitochondrial DNA that indisputably linked it to Chris. They couldn't say with 100% certainty that it was his DNA, but they could say it was his with like 99.9% certainty that it was his. There was some like really distinct thing in his DNA that a very small percentage of the population has. So the likelihood of someone driving his car and having that marker in your DNA is so very slim. And as I said earlier, the Porco's home alarm had been smashed, but first it had been disarmed with the family code. And Chris was one of six people who knew that code. So they believed Christopher drove to his parents' house, went inside, disarmed the code, went to the garage, and grabbed an axe before going upstairs to attack his parents. He then cleaned himself up, staged a robbery, cut the phone lines and the screen on the window before driving back to Rochester. They also suspected that Chris had been wearing a pair of scrubs that he had from the time he had been working in a veterinary clinic to avoid getting blood on his clothes. His job at the vet clinic also gave him extensive experience in cleaning up after veterinary procedures, and he was specifically trained how to clean up blood and to not leave any trace on himself. So there was all of that. In November of 2005, a year after the attack, Christopher was indicted for the murder and attempted murder of his parents. His bail was set at $250,000, and his friends and family raised money, including his mother and his boss at the vet clinic, who he had stolen from. Joan still claimed she had no memory of the attack and believed her son was innocent. She would regularly be seen walking arm in arm with her son at the courthouse, and she even threw him a 23rd birthday party while he was out on bail, and there was some footage from that party filmed for 48 hours. And her statement from that night when she said Christopher had done this to her was deemed testimonial hearsay since she had no recollection of the attack, and it was made inadmissible in court. Christopher hadn't shown any sadness over the death of his father, and he was seen in photos partying with friends after everything as if he didn't have a care in the world. He was also known to speed recklessly into the court parking lot, and one of those times he apparently almost hit jurors. And although his mother believed Christopher, his brother did not, along with a few other family members. When Jonathan, Christopher's brother, testified at the trial, it was reported that he never made eye contact with Christopher. He said his relationship with his brother was strained, and Christopher knew his parents had life insurance policies. During the trial, the prosecution painted Chris as a sociopath who would screw over anyone to get what he wanted. He murdered his father and attempted to murder his mother because they discovered his lies, and he wanted their life insurance policy money, which they said was his main motive for the attack. The defense claimed that Christopher couldn't have done it for a bunch of, in my opinion, weak reasons. The defense was claiming that the crime scene was so bloody, there was no way anyone could have been in there and not have any trace of blood on them. But the prosecution argued that the crime scene that the police found was not the crime scene that existed when the murderer was there, because Peter got up and walked around spreading blood all over the house way after the murderer had left the scene. Also, the prosecution said that there was a chair in Joan and Peter's bedroom near the bed right next to where the murderer would have been standing, based on blood spatter analysis. And the chair didn't have any blood on it, meaning Christopher could have committed this crime and gotten no blood on him at all. But even if he did, he knew how to clean it up, and he definitely had a change of clothes in his childhood bedroom. And Christopher would have been in the house for a few hours, which gave him plenty of time to clean himself up. So it wasn't a very good argument. The defense also argued that Christopher had no history of violence. And my personal favorite, he couldn't have gotten gas with cash, because what young person has cash on them? Christopher would have had to fill up his car at some point during his journey, and they said, there's no trail of it. He didn't use a credit card, and young people don't use cash. I'm sorry, but if you're planning on murdering someone, you're going to bring a little cash with you. Young people don't typically murder people. Ever think about that? They didn't have any physical evidence, so the defense had to make the jury believe that all the circumstantial evidence was a coincidence. And as we know, there was a lot of circumstantial evidence. There was Peter and Joan being upset about Christopher's financial fraud, the fact that nobody saw him on the couch in the lounge, he was seen on surveillance video leaving and returning to the campus at the exact time he would have needed to, two toll booth drivers saw his yellow Jeep on the way to his parents' house, his neighbor saw his yellow Jeep in the driveway, two toll tickets that perfectly matched the time he would have traveled to his parents' house and back matched the exact timeline as the surveillance video that also had a near-perfect match DNA, and to finish that off with the complete lack of emotion after his father's death and mother's attack and photos of him partying while he was on bail awaiting trial. Quite a bit. Quite a bit. So, unsurprisingly, Christopher was found guilty of one count of second-degree murder and one count of attempted murder, and the judge sentenced him to 25 to life for each of those counts. He will be eligible for parole in 2052 when he's 69 years old, and after going to prison, Christopher immediately filed for appeals, which he lost. And all this to be said, my heart breaks for Joan. Throughout the whole trial, Joan stuck by her son, and she still believes her son is innocent. Chris claims his innocence as well. and has done multiple TV interviews to say so. Not much is known about Joan today, although I did find an article saying that she is still working to get her son out of prison. She said, "We are both blessed to have been able to speak to each other almost every day of the nearly 16 years Christopher has been in prison, and we have literally lived the ups and downs of this entire chapter of our lives together." She also said, "It is time for the truth and facts to prevail and for justice to finally be done. With this in mind, I respectfully urge the court to either grant Christopher's motion to vacate his conviction or order a full hearing so that all the facts may come to light." So it's very clear that even still she believes her son is innocent. And that breaks my heart. I hope she finds peace in all of this at some point and she is able to move on. Although that's definitely easier said than done. But it's safe to say that we wish her nothing but the best. Because at the end of the day, she's just a mother who doesn't have memory of that night and believes her son. It is amazing that she survived, and I wish her nothing but the best. But anyway, I wanted to leave off this episode by saying something about Peter Porco, because in my research, I found a little blurb about who he was as a person. Peter Porco was described as a loving father and husband. He would go out of his way to help anyone, especially his sons, Jonathan and Christopher. He had a long, distinguished career in the legal field, and he was especially proud of his work representing the interests of children. He was an active church member, a kids' sports coach, and was a very active member in his community. He will be missed by so many. He was only 52 years old. But that is where our story comes to an end. In my opinion, there is far too much evidence to prove that Christopher had done this. And he was found guilty, so I believe he did it. But let me know your opinion, because I'm curious if anyone has any other thoughts. But assuming that he did do it, because, hello, he was found guilty, it is crazy to think about all the stuff that he thought he could get away with, and he just carried them out in such a poor way. For going down the path of kind of a life of crime, he was doing a pretty bad job of it. It's like, you didn't really cover your tracks very well. You didn't think too many things through. You're just kind of doing what you want to do and hoping for the best. And that's really a crazy thing. That's a pretty insane thing to do. What I want to know is, did he know that his father had bolted that window shut from the garage and just hope that the police wouldn't lift it any further than those 4 inches? Because he cut the screen, trying to indicate, hey, this is where the person broke in, this is their point of entry, but, and then, you know, opened the window. But when the police tried to open it, it didn't go any further because, you know, he used that window to be his, like, robbery staging window, and his father bolted it shut. So that's just such a simple, like, go to a different window, cut a different window. I don't know. I don't want to give him pointers, obviously. I mean, I can't give him pointers, he's in prison, but, like, it's like such a simple thing to be like, okay, obviously someone can't squeeze through a 4-inch hole. Also, home alarm systems keep records. Anyway, it's all very interesting and sad. But that's all I really have to say about that. Why don't we move on to something a bit lighter, and I will leave us off with a bit of a palate cleanser. And I'll tell you something good. My good thing is that I got to take a nap with a French bulldog the other day. It's my friend's dog, Bo. Shout out, Bo. It was such an amazing time to just snuggle with a dog and take a little snooze. That, and I got to spend some time with my friends that I don't see very often, and I love them very much. And yeah, it was just an amazing time. My life gets exponentially better every single time I get to hang out with a dog, and that was one of those times. Kind of a quick good thing, but I mean, hey, you can't argue with me that that is a good thing, because it really is. If you have a pet, go give him a squeeze for me. But anyway, thank you so much for listening. If you would like to check out that bonus episode that came out, go over to our Patreon at patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. Get your merch while it's hot at nottodaypodcast.myshopify.com. If you would like to see all the pictures we post of all the stories we talk about, check us out on Instagram at nottoday_podcast. If you or anyone who has a story of survival that you'd like to share with us and possibly hear on an upcoming listeners episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. We have a TikTok that is nottodaypodcast and a Twitter that is nottodaypodcast, but the T on the podcast is a 3. Can I say it any quicker? No. And just keep breathing. Yeah.